This is Studio Potter, the podcast.
My name is Mike Jensen. I've been working in Clay since 1969, and I'm here as a member of the board of directors of the Archie Bray Foundation to introduce our panel. We all are familiar with these people and their accomplishments, so I've decided to dispense with the bios and try to speak from the heart a little bit. I'm not unlike many of you here today, and I expect at some time we've all read something or walked out of an exhibition wishing we could thank those responsible. I've personally experienced that feeling regarding all four of our panelists today. I'd like to start with Ken Ferguson. Ken, I've always admired your work and followed your career from afar. Today, though, I wish to thank you for being a teacher, a mentor, and a friend to so many who've become my friends and contemporaries. These people are now inspiring others, as you still do, all over the country with their work and their teaching. Personally, I want to thank you for your role in influencing David and Ann Shaner to Montana. The Brays survived because of them, and Montana and my life are richer by far. Rudy, in the early years, Montana may not have always understood, and I know there must have been opportunities to leave. But your success at the Bray and the University of Montana, in large part, created the ceramic tradition we now treasure, and we've come to expect in Montana. You're now an international artist, but Montana has always been enriched by your presence here. On a personal note, I want to thank you for giving a non-art major the chance to do clay. I know I wasn't your best student, but I hope perseverance counts. Peter Bolkus, in the beginning years, you couldn't possibly have known where it would all lead. You've to date already inspired two generations of artists, myself included. All I can say from my heart is thank you, and I hope we here at the Archie Bray Foundation have made you proud. I'd like to pose a question for you to think about right now. Would you miss Studio Potter? In my opinion, our moderator today has few equals. For almost 30 years, a working artist has published Studio Potter, a name that we've come to look forward to seeing with information we can trust. His interviews are always timely and interesting. I hope I speak for everyone here in saying thank you very much. Your panel moderator, Mr. Jerry Williams. Jerry?
The following voices will feature Jerry Williams, the founding editor of Studio Potter, Ken Ferguson, Rudy Audio, and Peter Bolkus. This recording is from the Bray's 50th anniversary in 2001. Before we step back into history, for more than 52 years, Studio Potter has been dedicated to documenting and celebrating the voices that shaped the field of ceramics. Our legacy is built on storytelling, sharing the journeys, philosophies, and practices of artists who transform clay into culture. Are you passionate about ceramics and the stories behind the work? Join our community today and help sustain this living archive. As a member, you'll gain access to exclusive content, in-depth interviews, and behind-the-scenes insights from across the ceramic world. Your membership directly supports Studio Potter's digital publication, podcast, and archival preservation, ensuring that stories of today's artists continue to inspire future generations. Join us and become a part of a community that values craftsmanship, creativity, and connection. Head to our website, studiopotter.org, and become a member today, or consider donating. Please enjoy this archival audio.
Is it on? Thank you for that introduction. I, of course, am honored to be here in
a celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Brave Foundation, and certainly to be a member of this very distinguished panel. When I was first asked by Jeff and Robert to be the moderator of this panel, I thought that the safest thing for me to do would be to introduce them briefly and then get the hell out of the way before I got trampled to death. So I almost decided to do that, but yesterday and a day before I thought better of it and have revised that format just a little bit. So with the kind permission of the panelists, I'd like to give some preliminary insights into the year 1951 when the Brave Foundation began, and then introduce the panel members and pose some questions to them for them to answer and elaborate on from their own experiences. The theme, of course, of our panel is In the Beginning. And I did not think that Jeff had in mind to go back to the biblical creation and talk about religious subjects, but about the Bray in 1951 when it started. To understand the Bray, I decided to try to go back and look at 50 years behind me. And that was only 2 years after I'd started working in clay myself. I did little for 10 years except exist in a fog, so I couldn't find much in my memory to dredge out of 1951 and had to do a little digging. And here's a little of what I found. Politically, 1951 was not an easy time for this country. America was at war in Korea. General MacArthur had just been removed from his command in Korea. The Cold War was in full swing. President Truman, in his State of the Union message, discussed, quote, the deadly challenge of Russia, unquote, and steps to meet it. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg had just been sentenced to death for passing atomic secrets to the Russians. Drafts of 18-year-olds was being pressed by Defense Secretary George Marshall. Henry T. Moore, Negro educator and coordinator for the NAACP, was killed and his wife was seriously injured by a bomb which wrecked their home in Florida. Moore had campaigned to have Sheriff Willis V. McCall prosecuted for killing a handcuffed Negro prisoner. At the same time, Jawaharlal Nehru, Prime Minister of India, said, and I quote, it will be good if all the statesmen of the world controlling the destiny of millions of people keep quiet for a few months. Better still, he said, if the press of the world keeps quiet for a few months too, this will advance the cause of peace, unquote. But you may remember also that J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye was published in 1951. Here we have a novel of lost innocence, yet of great anger. Another perspective on the year in which the Archie Bray was founded was when I began to look back at the Kraft publications of that year. Take Kraft Horizons, for instance, our parent publication from which all of us sprang. Then in 51 was a magazine of modest dimensions. Numerous articles published in 1951 extolled the concept of design, perhaps reflecting the lingering influence of Scandinavian design. Design, a Common Language, was the title of an article by Henry Varnum Poor. He wrote in conclusion, quote, be true to yourself. If you are a potter, be true to your own particular lump of clay and to the fire that makes it immortal, unquote. In 1951 also, Beatrice Wood wrote in Kraft Horizons A Potter's Experiment, an article described as, quote, combining ceramic creation with life in the Ojai Valley, gardening and selling to visitors from far and near, unquote. Another article, Ceramic Lamps by Nancy Wickham, was described as, quote, a distinguished young potter charts the hard path to an artistic objective through application and hard work, unquote. Paul St. Gaudens wrote about the mechanics of a potter's wheel, with diagrams showing the working parts of a treadle wheel. Advertising in Craft Horizons then was rudimentary. Liquid underglaze was being sold by Jack D. Wolfe in New York. And John B. Kenny's book, The Complete Book of Pottery Making, was advertised for sale. Schools were listed, Craft Students League of the YWCA in New York, the School for American Craftsmen in Rochester, Haystack Mountain School of Crafts in Liberty, Maine, Pond Farm Workshop in Guerneville, California. No galleries were advertised, quite an innovation, but an exhibition at America House was described as, quote, the beauty and allure achieved through hand fabrication, unquote. A phrase that would surely make any current editor shudder. And the 16th Ceramic National at the Syracuse Museum awarded prizes. Victor Schreckengost for a large ceramic plaque, Robert Turner for stoneware pots, and someone named Peter H. Volkos for his decorated earthenware. I asked him to say it wasn't so, but he agrees that it was so. Well, what I'm trying to say, I think, is that 1951 was a very interesting and seminal year for many of us. First, as I've indicated, we lived in an angry nation, and I hate to tell it now, but a lot of art comes from anger. Secondly, it's clear that the craft field was waiting to be developed, and everything that happened here at the Bray and other places indicated that it was an important watershed for many of us. It's now my pleasure and honor to introduce our three distinguished panel members. If you were born yesterday, this is for you. So the amazing thing to me is that they are living archives. And if I could place them between two sheets of acetate and put them in a box, we would be safe for the rest of history because they know so much about our history at this time. But Rudy Audio first. Rudy was born in Butte, Montana. He was educated at Montana State College and at Washington State University. He taught at the University of Montana, Missoula, he's professor emeritus. And he's had many awards, the fellow of the ACC, honorary doctorate at Maryland University, and he is recently one of the 100 most influential Montanans of the last century. Ken Ferguson was born in Elwood, Indiana. He was educated at Carnegie Tech and, as we know, at Alfred University. He taught for 6 years at the Archie Bray here and then went to the Art Institute of Kansas City, from which he became emeritus. Ken has received the INSEECA Teachers Award, ACC Gold Medal, and he has works in 25 different museums. You may clap.
Pete Volkos, also born in Montana at Bozeman. He was educated at Montana State College, California College of Arts and Crafts. He taught at the Los Angeles County Art Institute, University of California, Berkeley, from which he is retired. He has infinite number of awards, ACC Gold Medal in 1986, Montana Governor's Award for the Arts in 1985, and a Distinguished Artist Award for Lifetime Achievement from the College Art Association in 1997. Our plan is to enlist the panelists in answering certain rather general questions. And since our mandate is to deal with the beginning of the Archie Bray Foundation, most of the questions will be related to that subject and related subjects as well. If you have questions, please hold them to the end, and we'll open the audience up to questions from the floor in the last minutes if we have time. So the very first question, obviously, is the most pertinent one. And I'll start asking Ken first, when did you come to the Bray? What attracted you to the place? And what was your role in the beginning?
I arrived June 11th, 12 o'clock, 1958. Drove out here from Pittsburgh. We came through White Sulphur Springs and Townsend. And I pulled in, and Ruth and Archie met me, and Gertrude, and our son Russell. But first we stopped at a motel up on the hillside, and Gertrude said, if you're the one applying for the job, you should go in and clean up. So I went in the motel, and we paid her $2, and I showered and shaved. But she made sure she stayed there, and she made sure Gertrude and Russell didn't go in. Okay. So what attracted me to the place? Well, as I said this morning, when they had the panel, I think the main thing about the magic of the Archie Bray Foundation is the magnets, and you have to have a good magnet. And there was a magnet, and his name was Peter Volkos, and then Rudy Audio. And people at Alfred said, where are you going? I said, well, I've never been there, but we're going to Helena, Montana to the Archie Bray Foundation. And they said, what's there? I said, the Archie Bray Foundation. Good place to work. And they said, well, tell me about it. I said, look, I don't know anything about it, but if it's good enough for Peter Volkos, it's obviously good enough for me. So we came out here. We had never been west. We thought we were on the moon when we were in South Dakota. And I was just looking for a pretty good job, and I had a job offer at Toledo Museum. I went down there and looked it over, and I thought, there's got to be better places than this. So I came out here, and we fell in love with the place immediately. We really took to Montana, no problem at all. Loved it. And let's see, you have one other question here. You say, what combination of factors converged to begin the Bray Foundation? It was Archie's dream, and his two friends, Pete Malloy and Branson Stevenson. And I never met Archie. I knew Branson and Pete Malloy. I never met Bernard Leach. I met Hamada. I haven't met all of those people at all. And I was looking for a place to survive, to be able to function. I didn't know much about that dream, but I did find out they were a tough act to follow, very tough act. You'd have an incredible ego, to think that you could make people forget those two guys is impossible, and it was St. Rudy and King Peter. And they were a tough act to follow. They had skill. They took chances. They had done very good work. And I helped Archie a little bit by working in a brickyard, making certain that the clays were tested properly. How much barium carbonate did they need to get rid of the scum? How plastic were they? And that sort of thing. So I tested all the clays that came through. And poor Archie had built a big tunnel kiln built by Herrick from Pittsburgh. I remember the man's name that sold it to him. His name was Fred Ford. And it was a hell of a kiln, but it produced too many bricks, and they didn't have the clay. And Archie just didn't have enough good clay anymore. The Blossberg pit was almost finished. They tried clay from Whitehall. They tried it from Ovando. They tried it from Red Mountain. They tried clay from everywhere. All the clay available in this area. So Archie had a dream. And I think it has something to do with Palo Windows, because he sold them. And they said, you get things going there real good, we're going to build you a windmill theater. Is that right, Rudy?
I think that was in the works, Ken, somewhere.
He was going to put the windmill theater where the swamp is.
Okay.
So this is a man that had dreams, and a place like this would have to start with a dream. Rudy, would you...
I was just ruminating in my head here, trying to figure out just when I got here. It's been a long time ago. I think that I had just finished one quarter of graduate school at Pullman. I really didn't have a lot of interest in clay at the time, although we had gone through a wonderful program with Francis Enska down at Montana State College, where we all learned a great deal about the basics of working in clay. Francis, and it was very basic. Francis used to dig her own clay, and we just thought that that's the only way you did it. That's what I thought. I didn't know you could buy it in bags. And so we went around. Pete was a young student there at the time. He was very interested in ceramics. And we went around trying to find different clays that we could use, because we thought this is the way you did it. Francis already had a good source of clay from near Lewistown, which was called Lewistown Pink, and I think she still uses it today. But we prowled around, found clays around Bear Canyon, and they weren't bad clays. They're pretty good earthenwares, and this is what we used. So that was the kind of a thing that sparked my interest to some degree in clay. But I was not one to go doing this little crafty stuff. I wanted to do important work, like sculpture on buildings, which eventually I started to do, but it wasn't with bronze and steel and the kinds of things I had in mind, and it was actually clay that I eventually came around to. But I think I had put in about a year of graduate study at Pullman, not learning about sculpture, not learning about anything much. And then Peter came along and he said, let's go to the Archie Gray Foundation, or what became that, the Western Clay. There was a guy up there who wanted to hire a couple of us to make some brick and learn about that, and to maybe even make some pottery. So needing a summer job, I thought that was a pretty good idea. And so I joined Pete with Archie at the Archie Gray Foundation, and we pulled along another guy, Kelly Wong, who's in the audience here somewhere, and so we were the ones who helped him get going.
What did the Archie Gray look like then?
The Archie Gray Foundation. Well, I don't know that it's proper to call it that. It was really the Western Clay Manufacturing Company. And where we were working in a drying shed in the back of the brickyard. And our station of work was right next to a noisy, huge, coreless steam engine that pumped away all day long, and we couldn't hear each other think in there, but we had our potter's wheels there, and we had our working stands, and we were putting our feet through the floors half the time because there were large spaces in there. And there was dust all over the place where the big straps were strapping away in the air, and we were having a hard time breathing. It was a 19th century workshop. And when we weren't making bricks and Archie needed a few hands, he would call on us. And I should mention that from 9 to 5, I was a kid. He says, "Hey, kid, I need you over here on the line." So I'd go over there and nip bricks. Then after 5 o'clock, he started to call me Rudy. He was very nice to us afterwards. So we nipped bricks and we made pots. Those early pots were put into the top of the kilns, and they were salt-fired, and they were pretty good. I didn't make much pottery even then, but I did a little bit of sculpture, and they were salt-fired on top of the kiln. And I think that the workmen who had to break loose all the brick, having had the kilns salted about 2 or 3 times to get a good glaze on them, didn't like us very much. And it usually took about 3 or 4 days longer to break apart a kiln that had been salted heavily than it did on a normal operation. And as I recall, that was something like the atmosphere, what it was like. Memory dims after 50 years, but it was a pretty interesting time. And second year, of course, we did a lot of building of the pottery building then. We learned how to lay bricks. We had a lot of volunteers from the community and elsewhere around the state that came to help us build a place. And as Francis said once, it was a miracle that the pottery building stood up, because it had so many amateurs laying brick on the place. I recall laying a course in what is now the office, and somehow I lost a course. Now, if anyone who has not laid bricks, it's not easy to lose a course, but I did. And that means that my mortar joints kept getting so thick that eventually they just ran out of space on top, and Archie had to put a false ceiling in the place to cover up all the mistakes. But we did learn. We laid bricks, and after a fashion, we got a kiln built. We got the first pottery built, and it's been functioning pretty well ever since. So that's basically the things that I recall.
And now for a break. We'd like to take a moment to extend our sincere gratitude to L&L Kilns for their generous underwriting support. Founded in 1946, L&L Kiln Manufacturing proudly holds the distinction of being the oldest kiln manufacturer in the United States. I recently had the pleasure of speaking with Steve and Dimitri Lewicki, the multi-generational family behind L&L. Here's a short clip from our conversation. So, Steve, the last time we spoke, you had mentioned that your mother was actually the kind of seed and origin story of L&L Kilns, and I didn't actually know that. So I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about your mother.
She started a pottery studio in Chester, Pennsylvania during World War II. It was pretty thriving after World War II. I talked to my brother about it recently. She really supported the early days of L&L manufacturing. Pitts Levin got sick. My father bought his share of the company out and didn't tell my mother, by the way, until he had done the transaction, which is kind of like that would be not done these days. And she was not happy about it. But the funny and ironic thing about it was she was a much better business person than him. So she actually ran the thing for the next 10 years. And then my brother and I took over the business in the mid-1990s. I was sort of self-taught, and I learned from my father, I learned from my brother, but I didn't have formal education as an engineer, or did my father. I mean, he just taught himself. When I was a teenager, I worked in the factory. I have a brother who's 2 years older than me, and he and I would work together. Like people that worked for him, his longtime secretary, Anna May, and this guy, Paul Littleton, who actually taught Dimitri how to weld.
When I was working in the factory, right, as a teenager.
You were like 16, I think.
Yeah, I just loved making things. And so I asked him to teach me how to weld.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was his first employee, right?
He was his first employee from like 1946. And he helped him build all these machines that some of them we still have. It was a family thing. The nice news is that Dimitri actually is a formally educated engineer and very creative, and you know, he's carrying on that tradition, but he's doing it with a lot more modern expertise. And Dimitri joined the company right before the pandemic. That was timely. You know, we've been designing, especially Dimitri, you know, these brand new kilns. Like we have this whole thing for plugging into 115 volts, you know, 15 amps, and people are loving them. In between all the years of experience that I have and Dimitri's creativity and staff and the fabulous team that he's put together, it's like just an amazing, it's fun. It's a lot of fun. It's still fun.
We return to our archival audio with Peter Volkis answering Jerry Williams's question of how Peter arrived at the Bray for his first summer there in 1951, where he laid brick, building the main stack and flue of the pottery.
Pete, your turn.
Well, can you hear me? I lost my voice several years ago. If you find it, bring it over here. Anyway, to add to Rudy's story, I remember when we were laying bricks on the pottery down there. Rudy was up on the scaffold, you know. And I was down there trying to pass up bricks to him. And Kelly was passing up the mortar, you know. I looked up there, and Rudy started to fall down. He came off the scaffold, slow motion, you know. I said, oh, my God, he's going to die. He didn't tumble off the scaffold. Remember that?
Yeah.
That's exciting, yeah. Anyway, yeah, that was quite a summer. I mean, I'm all the mosquitoes out there, Jesus. No wonder they wanted to put a windmill in there. Get rid of those damn things. I got bitten to death, you know. Ever since then, mosquitoes stay away from me. Which is good. I mean, I'm free. Anyway, I came here. I was in school in Bozeman, and people always had this nephew, Jerry Williams, who said, let's go to Helena because you heard this guy's building a pottery over there. I don't know who he was, but he's a friend of mine, he's my dad's, you know, so forth. And Hank Malloy, the painter. So I went over to Helena and met Pete and his brother Henry. Well, I met Henry later, I believe. But then I met Archie, and he said, you need a job? I said, yeah, I need a job. Okay. It was in between semesters of school. I guess I was going down to California then. But anyway, I started working there, nipping bricks, and I just started the bricks on the... He just had the slab worked out there. And Rudy shows up that same summer. Anyway, what attracted me to the place? Well, this guy said they're going to build a pottery out there. Well, I didn't want to particularly be a potter. I wanted to be a painter, you know. I didn't care about mud, you know. And that was the first thing for my mind. I didn't want to get all muddy. I put it off till my junior year in school. It was a required course, and at Montana State, and every quarter you got 25 pounds of clay. Put it in little garbage cans, you know. Put your name on it. So at night after we'll steal everybody a chunk of everybody's clay. I get a big lump going, you know. And I come through with this shit anyway. I sit there all night trying to make this big lump of clay go up. And I groin pulls and all that. Things started popping out of my butt and everything. And then I got to know the night watchman there. He's a grumpy old guy. I says, I got real friendly with him. I made him cowboy coffee, you know, every night. And then I'd be able to fire that little electric field there, steal some more clay, you know. And, you know, I finally got a couple pots of body, just Scandinavian design.
Not that big. Not that big. That's more like it.
I used to read these magazines, and they're nothing in them, you know. They'd have pictures, little pictures of Scandinavian design, you know, little tiny pictures of these good design bottles and stuff. Used to call them life and liftware, as opposed to dumb and death, like we used to call them. Anyway, I looked at these pictures, and they looked like they were about 3 or 4 feet high, you know. I finally got one up there. Looked like a big club, you know. Had a long neck, but looked like somebody scrolled up down the bottom, you know. Then I finally saw these things in the reel, you know, like Bert Freeberg and all those guys, those Scandinavian guys that just above. They're only this high, you know. Yeah, William Koga, remember that guy?
Stig Lindbergh,
yeah. And you know, they're only this big. And thanks a lot, you know. Get a couple of hernias over that. Anyway, you know, then it was good. I mean, we had a lot of fun. We had a lot of good food out here. And Archie used to take us into town every night to the Weiss Cafe, and we'd have lemon pie and all that stuff, and steaks and all that. And they had a hell of a nice cookhouse out here where we all ate, and all the men would eat, you know. And he'd make them all take baths before they came into the cookhouse. Every Sunday, he had to wear a tie. And they had this Indian cook, this lady.
Helen.
Big piles of steaks, you know, and potatoes and everything. It was a big ritual every Sunday. But you had to be dressed up, you know, shine your shoes and all that. Everybody used to have a tie on. You had all these guys in brick, that's all they wanted to do, go into town and spend their money on wine, you know. So we had all these winos every summer come out. They came out for years, because that was the season to come out, you know. I don't know what they did in the winter, but anyway, where was I? What was the question, by the way? What attracted you to the place in the beginning? I didn't know where else to go. I mean, I came out with, met Pete LaMalloy, and then I met Branson Stevenson. And then as soon as we got started building the first downdraft kill on the West Coast, you know, at that time it was the biggest kill around. It was only 45 cubic feet. But we had a chimney out there, it was 30 feet high, and it was huge, you know, and it would suck all the wind out of the kiln. You know, it was amazing. We built this kiln, you know, and couldn't get the temperature up, you know. And Archie would come by, and he'd always call me Kid, too, by the way. I don't think he ever called me Pete. He said, "Hey, Kid, give it more gas. I was trying to get the temperature up in the kiln. And you know, the smoke coming all over the place. Pretty soon the flue was getting red. And it was still black in the, you know, where the stuff was, you know. And the gas was just going through there and igniting in the flue. And pretty soon it was igniting in the staff, you know. And pretty soon at night, well, there's 30 feet of flame coming off of the stuff. I said, Jesus. And still, didn't even get hardly black in the where the wire was, and give him more gas, kid, to blow your head off. But anyway, they remember the flame coming out of that kiln. I said, oh my God, the place is on fire down there. So I said, hell with this goddamn thing. I'm gonna go to bed. So I turned the gas pressure way down to just a whisper, you know. We needed 14 pounds of gas. I fired that thing off at 3 ounces. Anyway, I turned it way down so I could get some sleep, you know. This is after about 2 days up, you know, and 2 days down, and I was tired. So I woke up a few hours later and I looked in there and it was white hot. I said, my God, almost melted the kiln. Anyway, I got up about 15 or so. Nice iron blues and stuff. Anyway,
all the shelves were melted.
Yeah, the one like this. All the lids were going like this. Yeah, and, you know, everything was popping, you know, dunting. But I got some nice iron blues, but it was fun. Peter, anyway, I learned how to fire.
Peter, when they built that kill,
yeah.
When they put the arch in, I discovered later, because we're the ones that had to tear it down. When they put the arch in, the glass brick, it's a key brick, it kept going down when they dropped it in the top.
It
kept going way down. And pretty soon, it's like, you know, like 6 inches of brick sticking out in the kiln. And they asked Archie, what are we going to do with that? He says, just knock it off. She took a hammer and knocked that all off. And I always wondered how that happened, you know. And then when they filled in the top of the kiln, you know, to finish it off, they poured concrete.
Yeah.
They poured concrete right on top of the kiln.
Why not?
Yeah, why? It's amazing. It's amazing.
That, I have to say that kiln was just a solid block of hard material.
Yeah.
And it had a small hole that we fired.
It was a solid block of brick.
It was a lot of fun to fire that.
It had about 7 pounds of gas pressure.
14 pounds.
Was this part of Archie Bray's dream, a kill of that kind?
Yeah. Have a kill with 14 pounds of gas?
Yeah.
14 pounds of gas, but make a kill in a room this size.
Yeah.
Fire real well, you know.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and anyway. Well, that was one of his dreams, and have his pottery. And...
Rudy, can you tell us something about Archie Bray's plans now for...
Archie had a number of different dimensions to his thinking, and especially about what was going to happen to the pottery. There was one that didn't go over with Leela very well. He wanted to build that windmill out there and dress her up in a little Dutch costume. And we would have free living space there, but I'm glad that didn't get off the ground. That's true. The windmill was an idea. But serious moments, he would talk to me about what he wanted to do. He wanted to establish a music center there, perhaps, someday. And he wanted to build a technical section to the foundation where he would invite research people to come in and do ceramic projects and engineering and the technical side of it as well, which was the reason that he bought a Globar kiln for us to experiment with, which was a fairly advanced kind of kiln to acquire in those days. It had solid carbon elements, which were quite an innovation in those years, and high temperature elements of various kinds, and temperature controls that were very accurate, presumably for a technician to come in and test clays. And I think it was in use for a number of years. As far as the rest of his ideas he had for the Bray Foundation, of course, none of these materialized because there was so much activity going on in just developing the pottery itself. That took a lot of time, took a lot of thinking about where we were going and what we were going to do. I remember that Pete and I, being quite young then and idealistic, we didn't really talk about art very much, surprisingly. We always talked about how to make a better machine, or how to make a better ball mill, or how to make this kiln function better, things like that. And that was about the extent of our conversations about art. And we didn't realize until very recently, I read the book, that we were such a hair shirt for these people, these wonderful trustees, that
ran the place. We were a couple of kids, you know, who didn't do what we were supposed to do. And I remember a story about, I heard this somewhat later, that Pete, who was casting some coffee cups that were to be sold, didn't like him, so he was out there on the floor busting him up with a hammer. And Archie looked on in amazement. I said, "What are you doing, Pete?" Because he saw all his profit going down into little chunks of broken, brittle, broken clay on the pottery floor. So there were a lot of things that had to be ironed out. One of them was, how are we going to make a living here? As it happened, Pete started to throw some wonderful pots, and pretty soon, year by year, month by month, people started to gather around the kiln, and they would buy them as soon as the kiln door was down. One of the buyers was Mr. Ford of Great Falls, who used to look at those things, and they were still smoking when they were put into the back seat of his car. About $35 for one of those wonderful, beautiful jars. They were, I'll say one thing about that kiln, it was just one of the most beautiful firing kilns that ever happened as far as our glazes were concerned, and they were extraordinary. Yeah. So that the collection that you find in Great Falls now of Pete's early work is really a very special part of that period of our formative years, and it's truly a beautiful kind of thing.
Ken, there's been some reference to the old guard and the new guard. Can you explore that subject a little bit? Meaning, I assume, Archie Bray and then the Vocos audio group.
Well, I guess the situation when I came was James McKinnell had run into me and told me I should come here. And it's actually interesting. He talked to me. He says, it's the best firing kiln in the country. He says, there's a kiln in the whole country fires as well as that. And, you know, he would bring the best pots here to fire them later on. So anyway, enough of that. But anyway, this business about the old guard and the new guard, maybe I represented the new guard. I really don't know, because I bought the whole package. I wasn't here to change anything. I bought into it, and I believed it, and I was fairly cooperative. I mean, I decided I wanted to stay here, so I would do a lot of, I did a lot of testing of clay for the brickyard, and even experimented with some bricks for the Great Falls College, and I learned a good bit about making brick, which I don't know if it did much for me later, but I did some teaching. It was a matter of survival, truly. I don't think I thought much else at all. I didn't have anybody to talk to about it. I had to go all the way to Missoula to talk to audio if I wanted to talk very serious about what's going on in the ceramic world. So it was a matter of survival, truly. Just put groceries on the table and keep the place going. I was alone. I didn't have any help. If I sold pots, the money went to Western Clay Manufacturing. If I sold a pot in a show or won an award, I got that money, which was the only way to make any extra money. But the brickyard was struggling at the time. And so here the parent was having as much trouble as I was having, and they just didn't have a clay, and they kept bringing in different people to run the brickyard, and it was tough. And so Archie left in 1960. Archie Jr. and his wife and daughter went to California, and then the Bray almost closed up then. I guess it could have. I don't know why. I guess I just wanted to stay, and my wife liked it, and we had two children, and then we had a third, a daughter, and so we had the option of, you know, like if we ran off, I think the bank would have probably closed it down. But there was other people who had influence, and they said, they're not causing any trouble, leave them alone. I guess that's really what happened.
Why did the government?
Well, there was a loan for the big kill. There was a loan for that big Herrick kill. It was a big two-tunnel kill, a tunnel for drying and a tunnel for firing. So it was a big expense.
It was a very advanced project for its time, I recall, when they were building it. And it was the latest in technology, and it was believed that we could compete in the brick-selling market if we would construct that kill. And Archie would be in a position to compete with Denver and Spokane and Medicine Hat in the way of brick sales.
It would turn out 17 cars of kill of bricks a day. And if you walk around over there, you'll see the size of the cars. There's still a lot of them lying around on the ground.
How much did that kill cost?
Well, I think it was $250,000 in 1950 dollars.
That was the extent of your mortgage to the government.
I didn't know anything about
it. And the building.
Yeah.
Big metal building.
So if everything had gone under, it would have gone under because of that.
Yes. Yes. And I was paid $300 a month. And I had a place to live where Pete lived. And Archie did a little improvement on it. And it was okay. It was more than adequate for the family. We did okay. We enjoyed living there.
And now for a break. Are you passionate about ceramics and the stories behind the arts? Join our community today and support the voices shaping the world of pottery. By becoming a member, you gain access to exclusive content, behind-the-scenes insights, and a network of like-minded enthusiasts. Your membership directly supports our digital publication, podcasts, and ensures we can continue to share inspiring stories and valuable resources. Join us now and be a part of a community that values craftsmanship, creativity, and connection. Head to our website, studiopotter.org, and become a member today or consider donating.
Now, may I change the subject slightly? The legendary visit of Lee Chamada Yanagi has received a good deal of press. Can any of you describe in gory details what that visit was like?
Well, so you want me to go on that one?
Yeah.
You can go on if you want to, Pete.
Yeah.
All right, listen, I'll talk. This was a time of great change for me and a change in commitment. Branson Stevenson had written and made the connections for the great Leech visit back in 1952, I believe it was. And so they stopped by, and it was quite a revelation to see these distinguished artists, gentlemen potters, come through and start to work with clay. And the minute I began to see Shoji Hamada work, I began to realize that it was more than just a piece of business of making nut dishes and fruit dishes and whatever we had for sale at the gift shop. Because he imbued his work with a spirit that was truly amazing. For example, the way he handled the clay, the economy of movement, almost kind of a spiritual connection that he had with the work, and would decorate it with sensitivity and toss it around in his hand and look at it and examine it for its beauty. And I could see the connection just like that, like a bulb went off in my head. I even tried to make Hamada pots for a while, giving up my pretty interesting business of making carved brick walls for churches and everything like that. But I think that the workshop experience there was an important one. I'll let Pete expand on that because I think it affected him too. And the other thing was that we just kind of got a glimmer or an insight into what Zen and the kind of pottery that Yanagi had a great deal of respect for. Dr. Yanagi, who established the Mingei Museum in Japan somewhat later. But to see the spirit of these men working together was quite a revelation to us. Succeeding workshops were important too, but this was the first one, and I think it was very significant. And I'd like Pete to talk about it, because he was the one who kicked the wheel for Hamada, and then we all watched him. Watch Pete teach Hamada a few tricks.
Thanks a lot, yeah. Well, I tell you, it was a great thing for me. I tell you, he'd be sitting on top of the wheel, and I'd be sitting back there. It was a kick wheel. And I'd be kicking the wheel for him, you know. And the wheel head was here. His head was here. Mine was here, you know. So I'd start kicking the wheel, and he'd say, go faster, faster, faster. So I'd kick a little faster. Slow, 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 slow down. He'd zip these things off the wheel, you know. And I just watch his hands. He had this Buddha-like hands, you know. His fingers, you know, are real beautiful, you know. It sort of looked like Segovia's fingers. I think all these geniuses have these little fat fingers, you know. Let's hear it. Yeah, he's got them, you know. Anyway, he wouldn't speak. People ask questions, and he wouldn't, he pretended like he didn't know English. So in a break, we'd go back to the back room, you know, and have a smoke and all this, and he just started speaking English to me, you know. He just didn't want anybody in his face out there, you know. He was, you know, I said, I don't speak English. You're like, hell you don't, you know. That guy was educated in England. Didn't he go to Oxford or something? I think he went to Oxford. Anyway, him and Leach. Anyway, Leach, he was out there with a suit on, a white shirt and a tie, and throwing these in jugs, you know. Never getting a spot on him, you know. Couldn't figure out how the hell he'd do that. Real stiff, stoic, you know, and he wouldn't even get dirty, you know. Well, how many didn't get too dirty, but I did. All this slop would come into my lap. I remember one time we drove him out to the, they wanted to go up the hills here, up the mountains, and do some drawings, you know. Leach and Hamada and Inagi. We're in the car, you driving, weren't you?
I think I might have been.
The Buick?
Leach was wearing a beret.
Oh, yeah, he always wore that.
And, this is artist's coat.
Yeah.
You know, Rudy talks about what a profound experience it was. And it was somebody else that had less of a profound experience. And Bernice Boone told me there was a little lady from Butte that came to the workshop, and she had like a blue hair and a purple dress and an apron, and she kept trying to make a pot, and she spent 2 days trying to throw a pot. And she had this little plaster bat, a little hunk of clay on it, and it had a hole in it. And she kept, so finally she ran up to Hamada, and she showed it to him. And Hamada had been looking at this for 2 days. And so finally, he put his hand on it, and he put his finger inside, and his and thumb outside, and he says, two tick.
That's true. Yeah, we saw that.
Two tick, yeah. Anyway, when we were up in this mountain.
I don't think she was from Butte. They're not that bad.
We have a letter. I don't know exactly how it got around, but it was written to Pete Malloy in February 1953. And Bernard Leach had just got to Japan, and he read his mail, and he had a letter from Pete saying that Archie had died. And so we have that letter that Rudy gave me a copy. I guess he got it from Pete. I don't know whether you've ever read it. It's a good bit.
I don't think
you.
So.
And so, I'm not very much of a reader, but Jerry said he would read this letter for us, and I promised some of his people yesterday. It's a short letter, and I think it's really quite a thing to hear.
I'd like to mention one thing, that this information was unearthed to me again after many, many years. I'd forgotten about it. So when Pete gave it to me shortly before his death a couple of years ago. It was, again, refreshed to my thinking, so I would like to have it read. It's a pretty interesting one.
I was amazed when I saw this letter because it is an example of authentic artifact preserved over many years to become an historical document. And those of you who are throwing away correspondence willy-nilly should remember that the most casual letter in your file from someone or to someone may be important years down the road. So, archival preservation, here we come. There is no date in this, but it is from Tokyo, by Bernard Leach. My dear Malloy, and you will pardon me if I stumble over some words because the script is a little, is handwritten, it's a little difficult to read. Your recent letter reached me in the midst of the first gathering of about 100 craftsmen from all over Japan yesterday. I took your letter to my little favorite room all by myself for a while, thinking of Archie, feeling personally stricken and rather overcome by this unexpected news, which is of his death. I can't express my sorrow, and in this I am joined by Hamada and Yanagi. We gained a real feeling of friendship and respect for Archie during those days in Helena. I am unable to write very much in the fresh throes of activity here in Tokyo, so I hope you will share this letter with Bronson and Mrs. Bray, and to whom we extend our sincerest sympathy. I have an unanswered letter from Archie in my case, and now too late, I cannot answer it in paper, in proper. But yesterday, sitting here and looking out at the Hiroshige landscape garden with soft falling snow, I felt very near to him, and I feel impelled to say that I hope that his wish, as expressed to me recently, that his plans for the future of the pottery work in the foundation and may be carried out. You know that we felt that a start had been made under Pete Volkos that held out a greater promise than any other place which we visited in America. It would be tragic if that came to naught. We arrived by air from Honolulu on the 17th, all pretty fit. The remainder of the tour went excellently well everywhere: Santa Fe, Grand Canyon, Los Angeles, Claremont, Mills, San Francisco, and Hawaii. We got eaten up with activities, but nevertheless, I managed somewhat to get rested in Honolulu. It is cold here in comparison with but hearts are warm, and the welcome back after 18 years is tremendous. The museum exceeds my expectations in all aspects, but the craft movement is its best everywhere, anywhere, unified and substantial. Please keep me informed with my very sincere and saddened greetings to all. Bernard Leach.
Thank you very much for reading.
Yeah, thanks for reading that. At the time, I have to say that I didn't think they had that much respect for the place. When they were here, this came as a surprise to me, and my reaction to the letter once I first read it was that I was really surprised that Bernard Leach had that much concern and faith in the future of the Archie Bray Foundation. His connections were much closer to that of Peter Malloy, Branson Stevenson, and Archie than he was to me personally, but he obviously saw some
future and the work of Pete, and that's what makes it rather interesting to me now.
Can we talk a little bit about some of the other people who are seminal to the Bray Foundation, such as David Shaner and the McKinnells?
Who wants to go on now? Anyone?
I could maybe do something with that. McKinnell was an engineer, and he loved making pottery, but he loved the technical side of it maybe most. His wife was a potter, and I met him. He came through Alfred, and then he was working at Old Deerfield, Massachusetts. And he just sort of admired my work, took my name, and then he started a correspondence. Before you know it, he said, there's a job in Helena, Montana, and I'll write to Archie if you're interested, and maybe you could have a chance at that job. And so McKinnell was a rather eccentric man, and but he was a valued friend as far as I was concerned. He has Alzheimer's now, so he couldn't come to this reunion. And as far as David's concerned, David Shaner was the student 1 year behind me at Alfred, and we were close friends through that last year. And then when I decided that I should leave here, and I think I left because my wife and I, we decided, I was 36 and we had three children. I thought, well, I can't own this place, and you know, what's my future gonna be? You know, I keep making pots for other people and keep mixing clay for other people. I thought I'd wanna do this for myself. So I left reluctantly. I really didn't wanna leave. And Pete Malloy says, why don't you just stick around? He says, we'll buy this big house over here next door and you can stay here until you're 70. Wow, it's far reaching. But anyway, Shaner quit his job at University of Illinois and moved out here, and we worked together for a year in 63, 64, and then I left in 64, and David stayed seven more years. And he was here at a very important time, because that's when the people in town decided they wanted to buy the Archie Bray Foundation. And they started, I don't know exactly how it all happened, but they had an auction and they actually told people, don't bid. Don't bid against us. We want to get this place. And so they only got just the pottery and the house and a little bit of that property. It was later on that Kurt Weiser and the board were able to buy the whole brickyard from Medicine Hat Brickyard. And they had bought it because they just wanted the place to stay idle. And so they bought that brickyard and everything very cheap, $75,000, I think, for the whole thing. And so they were two very pivotal, very important people that they were able
to work with the people in town. And of course, Rudy is close by, and so he knows a lot about this. But it was an amazing thing that they actually did pull all this off.
Well, I just wanted to remark about the importance of Dave Shaner to the place. And it's true that I didn't come over here very often to give him the kind of support I should have over those years, because I was so busy building up my own program at the University of Montana, where I had moved to teach. But I believe that under the tenure of Dave Shaner, it was probably the most important period in the time of the history of the Bray, because he did save it from receivership, and those were awfully lean years. I know they weren't very happy under you too. They were very difficult years, cold winters and all, and trying to keep you know, the bills paid and the pottery establishment moving. I think that under Ken and Shaner, they were the most important periods to the survival of the pottery. And I believe they deserve an enormous amount of credit for having made that happen.
And now for a break. As we enter the third phase of this oral history of the Bray, I want to take a moment to pause and insert an editorial note. The concluding segment of this panel has been edited for responsibility. Some of my favorite articles in Studio Potter's archives come from a generation shaped by lionized leadership, an era of tremendous creativity, yet also one shadowed by exclusion and imbalance. This is not to say that all members of that generation engaged in misogyny or personal conflict, but it's impossible to overlook how Peter Voulkos, in particular, embodied and perpetuated the gendered hierarchies of his time. The conclusion of this panel conversation is a sobering document of that. While this panel documents the early formation of a vital place and community, Voulkos's words descend into a pattern that exposes a male-centric worldview. His statements, at times, are degrading and dismissive. They reveal more about the performative tension of power and ego than they do about reality. As a contemporary editor of Studio Potter, I hold deep respect for the historical record, but I also have no interest in enabling or amplifying harassment, even when it appears in archival material. The decision to edit out Voulkos's derogatory remarks comes from both disappointment and responsibility. Disappointment in the persistence of those views and responsibility to name them as what they are. They are expressions of misogyny and abuse of authority. Ultimately, his words stand as part of a shared and complicated history, one that demands our reckoning. These moments remind us why cultural change was and remains necessary and how new forms of placemaking have emerged through the resilience of those who were and continue to be marginalized. There is a growing insistence on transparency, on recognizing when influence has been used selfishly or abusively, and when it has obscured the collective spirit that makes places like the Bray so vital. Misogyny, when left unexamined, narrows the field of vision. It shifts attention away from the shared labor and grace that sustain creative communities, reducing a space of generosity into one of self-centered performance like Voulkos. At Studio Potter, we believe reckoning with these stories allows us to move forward with greater awareness and compassion. The Bray's legacy has always been about more than individual genius. It has been about community, experimentation, and the quiet generosity of shared space. By naming past harms, we reaffirm that spirit and ensure that it continues to grow. Thank you for your understanding as we strive to honor the moments in history and the people and places that shape them, while also acknowledging and taking responsibility for the harm caused by individuals. Our goal is not to erase the past, but to approach it with integrity and care, recognizing that the stories we preserve carry both inspiration and injury. And now we return to the edited conclusion.
Thank you.
Peter, do you want to say anything?
Well, I was long gone by then. I knew all about what was going on, but I was out on the West Coast, so I didn't. The only thing I could say about Dave was I met Dave. I'd run into Dave here and there. He was one of the greatest guys you ever knew. And yeah, it's too bad he can't be here with us, but.
I wanted to run him for president, but he had better things to do.
Yeah, there you go. Anyway, I don't know what else to say except between Fergie and Dave, they kept the damn place going. Rudy.
One of the people that he has in his notes, Marguerite Willoughby, I spoke a little bit about this yesterday. I tell this little quick story about her. She was here for the first day of the break. It opened. So a lot of people came. I really don't know all. Ruth Bray told me this story, so I don't know exactly who was there. But anyway, it's a big deal. And they were in the back room of the original building, and they had Marguerite Willoughby for a workshop. And she decided she'd read a paper. Well, she actually was going to read her book.
Can we talk a little bit about a subject that I know you'll find very easy? And that is the subject of contribution. That was talked about this morning. And I would be very interested in your take on what the
years under Weiser's tenure went back to Shigaraki, and as far as the educational model that they'd established there at the wonderful Shigaraki Ceramic Center was patterned after Bray's. And I think that that's quite well known as well. So here, little Helena Montana with this Archie Bray Foundation is not only widely respected, but it's also modeled after in other institutions. As a, the model being, it's a fine place to work. People don't have to go to school all the time, but they go to a place where all the facilities are there and they can work. They can work in companionship with other good people, and that's what really makes this place tick.
What are your hopes for the future of the Bray?
My hopes for the Bray is that it will start to receive the kind of support that it deserves. And I think that we've been struggling along for 50 years and we've established our credibility as a sound institution. We're responsible. And maybe that's one reason we haven't had the infusion of help from the institutions, the financial institutions, and the people who would normally give of their wealth to sustain a good thing like this. But we have proved our case over and over and over again, and we're still here. And the other thing I look at are the quality of the exhibitions that we have here today. They're truly remarkable, very, very special exhibitions. If you go out to Bray's and see the current exhibition there by the residents, it's amazing. You look at the contributions that the people have given to the auction. It's amazing. It's totally first class, first quality. And if we can sustain that as our future, I think that it's going to be assured one way or another. Those are my opinions.
But it's some of the best work I've ever seen throughout the country. You know, I mean, I'm from the West Coast now, but some of the best shows are installed right here. You know, Rudy's show, Josh's show, you got to go see them. So, pass the hat.
Ken, do you have anything to add to this?
Well, I think I've sent a lot of students here. And I've always told them, I says, look, you go to Archie Bray and you're going to be better when you leave than when you get there. And I've never seen it fail. And there is something magic about it. I mean, I really wonder if there's a ghost of Volcus and Audio running around this place. Because people really pick it up and get it going here. And they were talking this morning a good bit about the magic of the place. And, is there really such a thing? And sort of what is it? I said it's the magnet. The people have to be a magnet, and they have to be a magnet every place. That you can't get, you know, like if I told a kid to go to Archie Bray, he'll say, even a young kid, just maybe 19 or 20, say, well, who's there? They want to know who's like running the place. And if I tell them a couple people they never heard of, they forget it, and they want to hear the names of people that are doing well. And I certainly agree with Rudy. The place certainly deserves some help and attention, but mostly help from the people who have benefited from the place. The worst thing we had going for us was we could run it on a shoestring. And we did. It's amazing how little money the place got by on. It was amazing. So, and, you know, they're all doing well. Like, Deweese is doing a good job. But this is a big deal now, big job, complex job, much different than when I was here. And even when Weiser was here. And Weiser did an excellent job. So it's in good hands. It's doing well. I just hope it keeps going. There you are.
Thank you for listening. Studio Potter is a small nonprofit. Please consider becoming a partner in underwriting or making a personal donation to Studio Potter. Your support can make a significant difference in helping us continue to produce high-quality, engaging content for our podcast and our digital publication. By donating, you enable us to bring in more voices, enhance our production, and expand our reach to broader audiences. Every contribution, no matter the size, directly impacts our ability to keep delivering the Clay stories and discussions you love. head to studiopotter.org and click on donate.